So I'm going to talk. First of all, I'm not exactly sure who invited me, but I want to thank you, Everett and Sergey. And I just want to remind people how nice it is being here in California. See, this is a picture. This is outside my office. And this is pretty, this isn't real time, but it's pretty recent. And it's different than here, I can assure you. I mean, this is serious. All these white dots, this is not film grain. It's
when was this?
Oh, I would say this would be two, three weeks ago or something. This is pretty serious. There's a lot of snow, a lot. So I'm going to talk to you about biological networks, and I'm going to go a little quick to the beginning, but you probably know some of the stuff, and I think Sergey introduced some of these ideas. But the bottom line is, I think that networks are a neat thing to study in biology because, you know, we have these genomes, and they kind of give us a parts list of all the things in an organism. And, you know, a lot of people want real detailed molecular understanding, and I don't know if we're going to get that understanding immediately. I think that's going to require, you know, a lot more experimental work. And so this kind of provides a kind of first level of understanding we can get for how sort of biological systems are put together, kind of wired together. And you all know this, there's lots of different types of networks, and so they provide a kind of way that we can talk about stuff from biology in a kind of unifying language to what you see in other disciplines. And, you know, as you've sort of seen too, there's a lot of different networks in biology. There's, you've heard of metabolic pathways, there's regulatory networks and things like that. And, you know, a nice thing is that you can make a picture like this where you can represent your genes and you put all the relationships down a piece of paper and you can represent a lot of biological concepts within this framework. So I'm going to talk, so that's just why we study networks and all. So I'm going to talk to you about some stuff today to do with kind of network comparisons, and, you know, we'll see how much time we have, and maybe I might talk a bit about how networks change. And there's sort of three things I'm going to talk about with these comparisons. I'm going to talk about how we can kind of gain a lot of intuition into how biological systems work by comparing, biological systems which we don't really have that much intuition for. There's a lot of sort of social and man-made systems that we have some intuition for. And then maybe I'll talk a little bit about doing some comparisons between biological networks and, again, how we can maybe compare them to some systems that we have some intuition for. So first type of thing I want to sort of talk about is, people talk about regulatory network as kind of the governing structure for a cell. And you know, Sergey has introduced you to the concept of the bureaucrats, the transcription factors being the bureaucrats. So I thought I'd start off and just remind people, you know, government system. And we did this work a while ago, and you can see it's a little dated.
Are you going to update the slide?
I don't know. But in any case, you're all acquainted with this. This is, you know, government, bureaucrats, hierarchy, stuff like that. But the key thing is you're acquainted with it and you have intuition for it. And so we've been very keen to try to disentangle biological networks into that type of organizational system. So we have a little way of doing a kind of breadth-first search on a network. It's actually not trivial to do this, where you sort of start with a directed graph, and you sort of like unfold it into a bunch of levels. You sort of start with the things that are all regulated, and eventually you get the thing at the top that is just regulating. And if you do this for a number of things that have well worked out regulatory networks, you get a picture like this. So this is the, so if you build this, if you do this kind of graph analysis, you'll end up with a regulatory network in yeast that looks like this. It's kind of like a big layer cake, you know. And here's an analogous picture for E. coli. So one of the things that's kind of neat that you can do with these regulatory networks is you can, for yeast and E. coli, which really separate them from biological or man-made systems, is you can do experiments on them, as you all know. You can knock things out, and you can see how important various genes are. You can see, if you knock a gene out, how it affects all the other genes in an organism. You can get a real sense kind of how the system responds. And so one of the first things you can ask is, well, how do the levels respond differently in our little government? One thing you might think is, oh, the things at the top are really important, you know, the president of the East is really important. But it turns out that as the things at the top are not that essential, so if you knock them out, nothing happens, at least the cell doesn't die. And whereas the things at the bottom are really essential, you know, comparatively, if you knock them out, more likely the cell will die. But you can also ask kind of the question, well, if the cell doesn't die, how perturbed it is? And you can measure how perturbed it is by how differently it grows, how different its growth rate is, or how many other genes are affected in expression. And what you find there is the higher up you are in this hierarchy, the more things tend to be affected. And so we kind of call this a paradox of influence versus essentiality. So the higher up you are in the hierarchy, the more influential you are, but the less essential you are. You know, I think this is kind of parallel to life here.
It's really counterintuitive if you assume that if you perturb something on top and it affects a lot of others, if you affect one of those things at the bottom strong enough, you should be essential, but you're not.
Yeah, no, it is a little bit of a paradox. You might think if you affect so many things, you should be essential. But I guess it's more you modulate many things. This even goes a little bit farther. But you kind of actually, if you really think through these sort of analyses, you actually realize, like, well, if you knock out a gene, it actually can potentially shift something on the hierarchy. So like if you knock something out, it might cause your hierarchy to have to be rejiggered and reorganized. But it turns out actually that the thing actually is sort of relates to this, that if you cause a bigger change from like one from a higher level to a lower level, it's still associated with an edge removal that tends to have a larger effect. So one question is how to gain a little bit of intuition. You know, why is it that the things in the middle are really essential? And you know, can we get some intuition by just looking at the kind of hairball type of graph? And you can actually get a lot of intuition. So one thing to look at is you can graph what's known as the out degree, or in kind of more commonsensical languages, the number of direct reports for each transcription factor. And so it turns out the guys at the top really don't have that many things that directly report to them. They just kind of regulate a few other genes, and then they're kind of effect diffuses out. Whereas these guys are like factory foreman, and they have like a whole bunch of things that report to them. And you can see the sort of this out degree peaks at the middle level. And what's kind of fun is, you know, we've tried to compare this topology, you know, to get some intuition to social network, and I don't know if this slide came out so well, but it's this is a comparison we made to a governmental system. We originally wanted to compare it to the U.S. government, but you know that is actually much more complicated than microorganism. I mean, when you actually try, you realize it's many, many more than four levels. It would make a picture that would not compare very well. And so it turns out that yeast is very comparable to a little city-state called like Macau. And this has about the same complexity. It's got one guy top and so forth. And it has a sort of similar thing, you know, where the middle people do most of the regulation.
Can I ask a a question based entirely on ignorance? I mean, you define the bottom as the ones that don't regulate anything.
Or do they regulate other, no, they don't regulate the transcription factors. That I should have made that clear. So yeah, I probably zipped over that. So the all transcription factors, all they do is regulate. So you can't be a transcription factor if you don't regulate something. I mean, I guess in transcription factor world, you either regulate non-transcription factors exclusively, or you regulate other transcription factors. So the guys at the bottom don't get the enjoyment of regulating other transcription factors. They can only regulate.
Okay, so it's a question. I was off by one level.
Yeah.
But the real essence of my question is, you count backwards, and you get to the top. Mm-hmm. And somehow our intuition, based on, we can speculate on what, is that that's where control really ought to reside?
It's not clear if you take the kind of, someone shows you this org chart for Macau, you might say, well, he's in charge of Macau. You know, that's sort of an intuition. You know what I'm saying?
But this has quite a different topological structure than the thing you showed us before.
No, not in terms of that. Well, to some degree, but not exactly. I mean, that's the point. I mean, it has the same issue of the, even though the person at the top, quote, is in charge of Macau, like I said, the actual working of regulation in terms of the number of reports, you know what I'm saying, to the is similar. There's this middle management kind of, I shouldn't say, regulation that's quite prominent. So actually, I'm arguing that they're actually, I mean, the topology is obviously not the same, and there's obviously lots of statistics you can compute for the topology that are going to show them to be somewhat different, but in terms of this aspect, they're actually similar.
If you rank the genes by the total number of genes under them,
yep,
their own little tree,
yep.
And with the people, that works, you get exactly the same ranking, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4. Here, like, if you look at that gene, fourth level all the way to the right, he just regulates one, and that just regulates one, and then maybe that one regulates a few.
Yeah, no, that's...
So his tree is actually much smaller than the one level below.
Well, yeah. I have a picture of exactly that picture. It's coming up. But I think you're right that that will give a slightly different picture. But if you... I think you can't look at this graph and actually count it, right? There's enough lines on it that I think you'd have to actually do the calculation to see how big that thing is, you know what I'm saying? So I do think that the ones at the top, they have differential size triangles they have, but they're actually still fairly like big footprints.
Yeah, after all, one of your previous pictures shows exactly this, how much influence, well...
Yeah, well, that's the influence guy. It's almost by definition that if you're at the top, you're going to be more influential.
Well, see, but that's exactly my point, is if you define the top as the guy that's not, the nodes that are not regulated by anything, then in human structures, that's the president. But if you start counting from the bottom the things that don't regulate anything else, then maybe what you're telling us is that most networks are only two units high. They go from the bottom line to the next line, and that's all it really takes in general to do biology. And then there's a couple of aberrations, but it's not that, although they're more removed from the bottom, it's not because they are somehow essential controlling factors. It's because those are some oddball networks that are just longer than most of them.
That's actually a little bit of the argument that I'm actually making in a way, in the sense that's sort of the idea with these being quote essential,
yeah,
but these not being essential. But the argument sort of is that the things at the top are they have this more of this modulating quality or something like that, and so that's exactly right. They're not essential. You can remove them, and you know, you, I mean, I don't know if you could remove every single one of these, but you could remove a large fraction of them, and the thing lived. Now it doesn't quite live the same way it did before, and I think that's sort of the that's actually the point I'm trying to make.
I guess all I'm trying to say is it seems like we're inclined to count from the top down, mm-hmm, but somehow maybe it makes more sense to count from the bottom up and ask how long are the networks.
Yeah. No, I mean,
you actually drew this from the bottom up.
Yes, that's right. That's right. No, that's right. I mean, I agree with what you're saying. I mean,
but when we draw the hierarchy of a government, we start at the top.
Oh, well, yes. No, I mean, yes, but you can also, when you look at Macau, I mean, you don't have to do that. You can also just say, well, you know, who just receives orders?
I don't want to dominate the whole hour of your time, but it seems like there's a reason why the guy at the top is called the commander in chief.
Yeah.
Right. And that there's no reason why that should be true in biology.
Well, yes, no, that's true. But I mean, topologically, though, you could build this picture. I mean, the arrows go down, but topologically, you could build this picture in Macau. You can just start from the bottom up. You'd say, you know, does anyone listen to you? Does anyone follow your orders? No. Okay, you're on the bottom. I mean, you could do it like that. I mean, it's not the way people tend to think. They're like, okay, well, let's start with the president, who reports to him, but. Yeah.
I have another question. Compared to the Macau government in the East, in the second layer, you have a lot of feedback.
I'm going to come to that. I'm going to come to that exact point. So there's differences between these, and I'm going to come to that point. That's exactly right. So yeah, I'm going to come. You'll see. I'm going to come to the exact point. So the question is, why are the things in the middle of the central? I'm trying to get at this from a topological point. And we don't exactly know why. But one of the issues, because they have such a high out degree, one thing that becomes very obvious is you can calculate this quantity called the betweenness, which is the number of shortest paths in the network that go through a thing. And things that have very high betweenness are called bottlenecks. Okay, so, you know, on the East Coast, we say it's like the George Washington Bridge is the bottleneck on the road network. And so you can kind of obviously see that this middle layer is going to have a huge degree of bottleneckness or high betweenness. And so you can see this creates kind of information flow bottlenecks. Okay, and so, you know, maybe to some degree, maybe that may be why, you know, things tend to be more essential there. Now, what's interesting is you can do what you're sort of saying is, well, now we can start thinking about different types of networks. We can start to think about how does information flow through different types of hierarchies. And so here's what you might call your, this is a little more like your Macau network, like a military type of network where, you know, everyone on the bottom, they have one boss, they report to them, the next layer goes up, you know, and so forth. And, you know, if this private wants to say something to this private, you know, he tells his boss, and it goes up, and it goes, you know, and so you get these kind of, you can obviously see how this type of network is going to lead to information flow bottlenecks. You can sort of see, like, in the stereotypical military type of thought process where, you know, you knock out this sergeant and suddenly all these troops don't know what to do, you know. So, I mean, people think about this type of stuff. And whereas this is another hierarchy, right, where there's mostly regulators at the top and there's mostly regulators on the bottom, but there's not as much sense anymore of this guy having a single master. It has a number of masters, right? And you can kind of imagine just on a really simple-minded level, well, what if I start turning this into this? And you can see, well, if I introduce a cross, like a cross-regulation here, so this guy now reports to two guys. You can see how it's going to kind of ease the disparity in information flow bottlenecks over this middle level, okay? Because now suddenly, you know, this isn't going to be as much of a bottleneck, right? You know, so information from this guy can also flow through that type of channel or something like that. And, you know, so one of the things that we did is we developed a really simple-minded measure of kind of local democratic structure or local autocratic structure, depending on how you want to call it, at any point in one of these hierarchies. And it's basically if you have a number of regulators, it's the amount of shared regulation as a fraction of the total amount of regulation for those two regulators. We call it the degree of collaboration. And, you know, you can have in this type of setup, you can have hubs which are very collaborative. You know, regulators are very collaborative. They share most of their targets, or you can have one that's very autonomous.
Are a significant fraction of those regulations, do they actually interact, or are they just two independent ones that kind of multiply in their effects?
Oh, you mean like in this picture here?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, you mean like physically interact? Physically, like
physically interact, or just if you look at the gene expression level, is it, you know, one multiplies it by?
That's interesting. We've looked at that a little bit. I mean, not. I wouldn't say enough so that we could definitively answer that. I mean, I would probably say they do probably do that. I mean, I think that they co-regulate. I mean, that's sort of the idea. I mean, I would say yes, yeah. But I don't have like a definitive thing. But yes, that would be my quick answer. One thing you find when you look at regulatory networks in a lot of different organisms, you find maybe it's more satisfyingly, but as you go from E. coli to human, the networks become more democratic and less military. Well, but I think it's sort of true. I mean, E. coli has a much simpler type of, you know, it's sort of more direct type of thing. Human, you have much more of these cross interactions. And as you build up the bureaucracy that Sergey was talking about, you build up more of a tangle of connections as well.
Were these arrow bars?
Say what?
Were these arrow bars?
The arrow bars describe the amount of collaboration is described actually for a node, right, or for a pair of nodes, right? And so I can calculate, and I guess I could just show you the average, but I showed you the range of collaborative values over the whole network.
This is very weird, though, that, you know, yeast and mouse look almost the same, and rat is quite different from...
No, I think that the reason that's the case is that that just reflects the unfortunate reality that these data sets are...
Yeast and mouse are experimental, they're model organisms that are really...
Yeah, well, it just reflects, I mean, we don't have the complete networks for a lot of these things, and, you know, some of them are not, I mean, not completely worked out, and I think the difference between mouse and rat just probably reflects more of a incomplete some aspect of the way the network is filled out data wise. I mean, that's just the reality of it. I think this is where we are with the data now, and this is just what you can get as far as data. I think it's definitely true that we compare human versus E. coli. I think that the amount of kind of cross connections is just obviously larger. You can look at the amount of collaboration of the different levels, and one of the key things is you get most of the collaboration on the middle level, and these are many different types of networks, you know. These abbreviations are like mouse, rat, yeast, and things like that. You get most of the collaboration in the middle levels, and then you can define, I'm not going to go through this in detail, you can define what the middle level tends to collaborate with, but the bottom line that's kind of neat is, you know, you can read all these, you know, as Sergey was pointing out, you know, you can read all about, you know, kind of bureaucracies and how bureaucracy is supposed to be efficient. And people write lots of papers about, well, it's, you know, if you have a huge organization and you want your organization to be efficient, you have to have all your middle managers talk to each other, I mean, and kind of work together, which is kind of a euphemism, and not a euphemism, it sounds sort of obvious, but you can find papers like this. So that was the first thing I wanted to talk about, and I know I'm going a little bit more slowly than I thought. So what I'm going to do, I think I have a bit of time, is I'm going to more quickly go through this E. coli Linux thing that Sergey alluded to, and then I'm going to get to this last thing in the comparisons. We'll see. That's probably what we'll end with. So Sergey has kind of alluded this to you that one of the nice things to compare to these biological systems is computer operating system, and actually I think it's a particularly apt comparison to, because, you know, people often talk about the genome as sort of the ultimate operating system. It's like the operating system for living things, and so there's really a sense of, well, how does this, you know, ultimate code compare to code that you use when you use, you know, a computer and stuff like that? Well, how is man-made design like natural design and so forth? And so there's a lot of obvious, you know, there's different ways of putting these two things into connection. What we decided is that a gene is kind of like a subroutine, and the edge, which is one gene regulating another, is sort of like one subroutine calling another one. And there's also this idea that, you know, in biology there's this big concept of mutation, and, you know, we also think about, you know, the subroutines is changing. And one of the really nice things about Linux that just makes it really cool is that you can download its whole existence from its moment of birth to now, right? And you can download every single version. You can download every single patch file, and so you can watch it evolve, right? Literally. And of course, bacteria, we have a fairly large number of these genomes, and so we can look at these things and compare them. I mean, whether that's an apt comparison or not, I don't know, but we can certainly make the comparison. So we can make a picture. Now, what's kind of neat is this picture, actually, they don't look the same, okay? So this one is not the same. This is, the Macau looks like the regulatory network, but Linux doesn't. So Linux actually is upside down. And in Linux, what happens is the things that are, in this one we just break it into three levels, master regulator, middle managers, workhorses. But it turns out that Linux has mostly things at the bottom Linux has mostly things at the top that call other things, and only a few things at the bottom, okay? So it's very different from E. coli, which has only very few things that are kind of regulating other things at the very top. Okay, it's a very different structure. And one of the, so we can think, oh my God, sorry about that. No, just to turn this off. It's so embarrassing to get a phone call during your talk, but. So there's sort of obvious consequences of the fact that one of these things is pyramidal, and one is that one of them is top pyramidal, and the other is sort of bottom pyramidal. And one is that the major kind of hubs in E. coli are outdegree hubs. They're regulatory things where, like this protein CRP is a well-known regulator in E. coli, and it tends to regulate all things. It's sort of more high, you know, a regulator. Whereas the things in E. coli that have the highest degree are actually indegree hubs. They're things that are regulated or things that are called, like a function like printk or you know, that is just called and you know, summoned by lots of other routines, is actually the things with the greatest connectivity. Okay, so it's a sort of different type of connectivity distribution. And then someone asked the question of earlier if we can kind of make these sort of regions of influence or total, how to put it, sort of what we call the modules. And so you can sort of, you can take every kind of top regulator and you can say, well, what's its total profile? Like how many things does it affect, right? And then you can also say for any two top regulators, you know, how much do they overlap? Like how much do they kind of share? You know, of things that they they regulate. And then you can say for anything on the bottom, how often is it reused by different top regulators? Okay, you know, so this guy appears to fall into sort of two regions of influence, right? And so one of the things that you find is it's pretty striking, actually, that in a sense it's sort of obvious, there's a much greater reuse of things on the bottom of the Linux graph than the E. coli graph. The E. coli graph actually is very separated into separate little modules on the bottom. There appears to be a lot of connectivity, but there's also a lot of redundancy. Things are not always reused. Whereas in Linux, there's this just everything is always calling these same set of things.
I wonder whether this is a fair comparison, because I mean, a lot of gene regulation is also repression. So I mean, there are things like printk in cells, but maybe they're constitutively expressed, so they do stuff all the time. But it's not reflected by links.
Well,
printk is not. I don't think I don't know. But in the computer, you have. It's somehow things work only when they're called. But there's, so how would you like integrate that aspect of?
Well, no. I mean, I agree with what you're saying. It's not that. That's a fair point. I mean, I would say that. I mean, there's certainly the concept. I don't know if I'd say call it repression in Linux, but there's definitely the concept of calling routines in different ways. I mean, you can call them at different arguments. I don't think that always invoking something is the same as like turning it on. I mean, there's many concepts of invoking something. I would also say that there's certainly the concept of something maybe being constitutively on, but there's no real processes, or there's no genes in the bacteria that are not regulated. I mean, nothing is devoid of regulation, okay? Everything has upstream regulation, okay? So, maybe one way of thinking about it is, you know, there's some things that they're regulated a little bit and they just endlessly cycle and just stay on. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, you could imagine routines in an operating system that are like that. You know, you sort of turn them on and they just sort of stay there, and the process, you sort of fork a thread or something and it just sort of stays on for a long time or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, I also have a comment, you know, related to Michael's, that in a regulatory network description, you indeed would not see much of an analogy between, let's say, there will be no analog of printk in E. coli. But if you view it somewhat differently, if you say, look at in the sense which I presented in my talk, say some of those downstream reactions in metabolic networks, they are being reused in huge number of upstream branches. So they are really, you know, I can even compare one-to-one comparison between how ubiquitous is the use of printk and how ubiquitous is the reuse of the same reaction, and you get the same distribution, not just So it's under a different angle, you get a much more similar than you would. So
that's fair. I mean, I think that's fair. I mean, I do think that's fair, that there may be some generic. I mean, my picture is leading to the idea that there's a lot of generic routines in Linux that are called over and over and over again, and that's not the case in E. coli. And maybe that's not completely fair. I mean, fair is not really the right word, but maybe completely accurate. But in any case, that's how we set this up.
How confident are people in what we know about the E. coli metabolic networks?
I would say that metabolic networks are, I'd say that the metabolic network we're particularly confident about, the regulatory network, which is what this is a little less confident, but I would say it's fairly, I mean, I'd say that for these, I mean, human and the more higher organisms are a little bit more incomplete, you know, but this stuff, I think they've mapped and, you know, are pretty complete and mapped fairly well.
So you could do this exact same thing with the metabolic network?
Metabolic network doesn't have the same connotation of control. I mean, you know what I'm saying? I mean, it's a different type of thing going. You could do graph analyses. I don't think you would think of it in the same pyramidal type of thing. I mean, a metabolic network is a pathway. You know, one thing is followed by another thing, but it doesn't have the same sense of the, like, as you follow the chain. It's not like that thing at the top is controlling it. The analogy is more to an assembly line as opposed to like a org chart.
You can think about it the same way with programs, right? They take something and they're like, hey, you take this.
That's fair. I mean, that's a fair point. I mean, there's certainly ways that you can think of programs as mapping onto kind of like that pathway type of structure and so forth, and less onto the the regulatory network structure. That's completely fair. So there's some fun things to look at here. So now one other really neat thing that we can do, which I do think is kind of fun, is that for bacteria and biological systems, there's a very, very well worked out idea of evolution and change. I mean, that's something that people in biological science have worked on extensively. And in particular, one of the things you can do with many bacterial, this is E. coli, but one of the things you can do with many bacteria is you can, as Sergey was kind of alluding to, you can compare them all, you can find the genes that are common or persistent among all those, and then actually there's a very developed concept of for the things that are the same, you can look at how many amino acids change, and you can actually calibrate a rate of evolution, and you can really think a lot about how things are changing. And so what we're going to do is for Linux, we're going to try to set the same type of thing up too. So we're just like when you're comparing many different organisms, you sort of find things that are shared amongst all the organisms and things that are not shared. Likewise, when you compare many different versions of Linux, you sort of have the same picture. There's some essential bits of the kernel that are pretty much there in almost all the versions, but they're still modified, okay? And then there are, of course, completely new things that are grafted on, okay? And so Sergey talked more about actually the latter. He's talking more about like new things being grafted. Now we're going to focus on the kind of core that remains. And one of the things that you can do is, of course, like I said, you can calibrate how much they're changing. And like in biological science, there's a particularly evolved discussion of this. And so what people often do is that you can calculate the evolutionary rate, you can calculate the average evolutionary rate of a given gene, you can actually calculate it you can calculate it in a raw number. You can also calculate a normalized number, such as what's called like a DNDS number, where you normalize that number relative to some background rate, and you can talk about is it evolving more quickly or more slowly relative to the background. And then people say if it's evolving more quickly or more slowly relative to the background, they say it's some form of under some sort of selection, whether it's negative selection or positive selection, and so forth. And so, and this is pretty well established. And so, you can make this type of graph where you see that most of things in most of these conserved bits in bacterial genomes are under what's called purifying selection. They're evolving fairly slowly, and there's a few things that evolve very quickly. Fair enough. Now, in Linux, one of the things that we did is we kind of like took every one of these conserved routines and we measured their evolution by looking at how many times they get patched. And so then we could sort of make a sort of similar type of graph, but actually it's interesting, it's not at all the same. It has you can see it has a completely different shape. Okay, and so there's certainly some things that seem to evolve slowly and don't change much. But the weird thing is there's this huge spike here. And so there's some things that there's actually a lot of things that change really quickly, or change a lot. Okay, a lot of things that are persistent, that are in all the versions, but that they're constantly patched, which is very different than biological system. And you can get a little bit of so you can get some interesting intuition for this. So in other work, we and other people have looked at the relationship between the connectivity in a network and how fast something is evolving. And usually, the patterns that come out from these pictures is that things that are more connected tend to evolve more slowly. And it's sort of obvious. If you're more connected, you know, there's more constraints on you. There's more. It's less likely that you're going to be able to tolerate lots of random mutations. Therefore, you don't have as many of them. Okay. What you actually have in Linux is completely opposite. You actually find that the more something is regulated, there's a weak correlation with the number of times the amount that it changes. Okay, which is completely bizarre, and we're not bizarre, but it's very counter. Now, how do you get intuition for what I just told you? The way I think about it is think about the road network. Well, when they fix things up in the road network, they're not going to spend all their time patching and working on roads that no one travels on. They're going to actually focus most of the construction effort on the most well-traveled roads and the things that are kind of like densest with connections, even though it's painful. And the reason they can do that, which is actually kind of interesting, is because when you operate on the road network or you make a patch to Linux, it's not random. It's actually a man-made change. And because it's a man-made change, you're not at as much risk that it will be fatal, right? So the point is you can actually operate on the highly connected component, at least ostensibly feeling that you're not going to harm the system as much as random change does into a bacteria. But I'll just point out, just in closing, I actually think that this is, of course, the root of a lot of the non-robustness in large software systems, right? Because the reality is that what's happening, this top-heavy design that we have, and the fact that a lot of the components that are most connected to other things are the things that we're revising the most. Now, of course, when we revise them, if we're doing like nice, object-oriented programming or whatnot, we ostensibly think that we're not going to globally affect the entire system, or we're not going to create fragility. But I think the reality is, I think we do sometimes, or something. And I think one of the reasons that biological systems are so robust is they completely eschew that whole philosophy. I mean, they basically sacrifice efficiency. They have tremendous amount of redundancy, but they never do that type of situation where they're operating on things that are highly connected and changing them very much.
But maybe they do it not because biological systems are so smart, but because they simply do not have this capability to do search and replace. Let's say, my favorite analogy, if you have a software program and you have all those functions and you want to add extra input to a function, in software you can do search and replace, and sometimes you get into trouble, but at least. Or you can hire a programmer who will go through every line of your code and do this search and replace. At least, but if in biology a function is used by hundreds of other functions, there is no way in the world it could happen by pure random
use. No, that's true.
It's a limitation which turned out to be kind of beneficial in the long run.
That's true. No, I mean, that's true. I mean, I think it's the reality is that the chain process in bacterial system or biology system is so much more simple, that you just kind of end up with this type of setup. So in just a few minutes remaining, I just want to sketch this last little topic and hopefully have the time for this. This will be pretty quick. So I'm going to slightly switch gears here a little bit and just let me So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk to you. I've talked to you about two types of network comparisons, comparing biological networks to social networks, comparing biological networks to computer networks. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about comparing a biological network to another biological network, looking at how the network rewires over evolution, and then make some loose comparisons of that rewiring process to what we see in various commonsensical contexts. Okay, and so, and I think it's useful keeping in mind kind of the paradigm that we're used to in kind of sequence research, which is much more developed in biological science than network research. You know, we have sequences. You know, people figured out how to experimentally determine these things, and the first thing they did, of course, they figured out how to align them and compare pairs of sequences, more sequences. And once they had done this enough, they started to develop models of essentially sequence change and sequence evolution. Okay, and now of course, what we're going to do now is try to talk about that for networks. So people have started to, of course, determine biological networks, you know, much after they've determined sequences. And there's now the very beginnings of, as I showed you, the E. coli network, the yeast network. People are starting to put them down next to each other. Now, of course, it's not obvious how you align two networks or something like that, but they're starting to think about how you do that. And then, of course, the next step after doing that is going to be starting to parameterize models of network change. And I just to kind of motivate this, I just sort of give you, people talk often about social networks, and you know, there's sort of this sense that, well, okay, there's many different types of social networks, and you can kind of have this sense that things change at different rates, right? So you know probably your family tree or something like that changes at a particular rate if it takes a certain number of years to change links, add links, and stuff like that. You know, change, but not that long. You know, maybe your job, you know, changes a little bit more quickly. Okay, you, I don't know, it maybe changes on the scale of maybe 5 years or 10 years, as opposed to family tree maybe changing 20 years or generation or something. And you know, social networks can change, you know, I don't know, days, you know, change really quickly. And so, you know, I think people are acquainted with this idea of there being this, in essentially a kind of social connection, but there being different rates of change. And so we want to sort of think about the biological networks in the same type of way. And this is a picture where we tried our best and to make use of the data. And this is a picture that sort of shows different species. These are sort of these weird abbreviations we've developed to make them fit into this nice table. You know, this is Saccharomyces cerevisiae. This is Pombi. You know, I don't know. You know what these things are. And these are different types of networks. So there's protein-protein interaction networks, which represent physical interactions between molecules. There's genetic interaction networks. There's the TF is a regulatory network, transcription factor regulatory network. MicroRNA is another type of regulatory network. Then there's metabolic network we've talked about, and then there's a phosphorylation network, which is a type of protein interaction network, but which is very associated with a kind of signaling or regulatory process. And you know, we have limited versions of these networks in many organisms. You know, and this data is fairly incomplete. It's very much at the edge of what you know is available. And so,
was that table existence of the network or existence of the data for the network?
Oh no! Well, actually, sort of both. I mean, there's no data for networks. Well, I guess actually, no. It's pretty. We said this when we say not exist. I guess this means that it's just not meaningful. There's no microRNAs in these organisms. Whereas when we say no here, it means the data doesn't exist, but it could. And so we can sort of start to think a little bit about how we might approach this problem. And this is like very much, you know. I'm not saying on the edge. The data is not completely there to do this, but you can sort of think about how you might do it. You have different types of networks, and you have different organisms, and you could imagine just comparing them. And as like I said, I'm going to talk a little bit about how you might compare things, but you could imagine taking any two things and kind of comparing them, right? And you could somehow, I'm going to talk about this in a second, if you take a given comparison, you could imagine coming up with some number that talks about how rewired are these two pictures. And then the key point is each pair of species is associated with a particular time of divergence. And people have an established idea of, well, you know, humans and chimpanzees, or 5 million years. Humans and mice are like 50 million years. There's an established idea of divergence between these things. Okay. Now, one of the questions is how to make this actual comparison between two things. One of the ways you can do it is you can sort of start with the nodes. There's this concept of orthologous genes, and you can match up a number of the nodes, and we call these things, the genes that are orthologous, common, right? And then you can, of course, you have this concept of, well, there might be an edge connecting this node to something else, but this gene just is not present in the other thing. So you can think of this as being kind of lost. And you know, when you're looking at the other thing, it's the sort of same type of thing. You can think of some, being something gained. And so there's sort of this concept of some of the edges really represent edges between common nodes or orthologous genes, and some of them really represent the process of the gaining and losing of nodes. And
do you have an out species to distinguish between gains and losses?
In what sense do you mean? I mean, this is only binary. I think there's no, take it back, I think these are equivalent terms, gain and loss. I'm just in the picture, I'm picking this as one, and this is two.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you don't try to distinguish.
No. I just, for this, in this way I've drawn it, I could have just flipped the picture around and made these squares in that triangle. It's just for simplicity and description.
What about duplicates?
What do you mean, duplicates?
Like
paralogs?
Yeah, paralogs.
Well, yeah, no, that I would call that a gain, because when I say common here, I probably should have drawn this picture better, but when I say common, I mean orthologous. And if there's an orthologous, like a one-to-one relationship. And you actually gain these, most of the time you gain things through duplication and kind of divergence. You can gain them through like horizontal transfer or de novo, acquisition of a de novo function, but in general, this represents paralogs.
There's also, of course, experimental noise, which, you know, my naive feeling would be that it will drown all the signal or much of the signal in data, where you don't see the edge. It doesn't mean that it's
that
they didn't happen to detect it.
That's completely fair. So I think that caveat is very important. I mean, like I said, this is very much at the edge of what, I mean, I think you can think about this, and that's the point, but I think, are the numbers accurate? I think the question is, the accuracy of that, of course, relates to just the quality of the data. And I mean, there's a lot of the data sets just simply aren't there. Even when they're there, they're noisy, and we're looking at many, many different network data sets, and that's just the reality of stuff. On the other hand, will there be more data very soon? Will there be more, 10 years from now? Will this data be there and more accurate? Definitely. And so, we're just thinking about this. And so, one of the things that you could do with this type of thing is you can think about how you might build a rewiring weight. And you can just, this is really simple-minded, you could just kind of say, well, how many edges change of the kind of common things relative to the amount of time that's diverged? And it'd give you some sense of an overall rate for the type of thing. And, one thing that's a little confused, complicated, is it's pretty easy to think about kind of the total number of possible changes you have the number of changes over the total number of possible changes. It's pretty easy to think about when you have a undirected network, but if you have a directed network, it's just a little bit more complicated. You have to take into account the edge orientation. But just to just jump right to the punchline, one of the things you do when you do that, you get this, when you do the little calculation, you get this type of graph like this, which I think is kind of interesting, where each of these dots represents a comparison between two species, represents a comparison of one type of network between two species. And so you can make it, you get a very clear sense, and you can see the graphs tend to slope down here, and they slope down. This is very much how sequence comparison works, because of the phenomenon of saturation. You tend to make the same change over and over again. But one of the things that you see, which is really clear, notice this is a log scale, we're talking very clear here, is that the transcriptional regulatory connections appear to change much more. These are, I guess, your party friends. And then you've got your bottom here, is your metabolic pathways, which just do not change very much at all, okay? And you know, in the middle, you sort of have a lot of the your protein interaction network and stuff like that. It's your sort of middle type of thing. So you do get, I mean, you do get a very clear picture of bands here, okay? And this is very preliminary. And you know, you can
relate that to sequence divergence, but there on the y-axis, it's not the rate, it's the number. So you need to divide the y-axis by the x-axis here to get to that. You know what I'm asking? Typically, we plot in sequence divergence. We plot, you know, the percent difference.
Oh yes. No. That's correct.
I'm just trying to get a sense of whether, and there, neither axis is typically log transformed. So I'm just trying to get a sense of how the dynamics here compare.
That's fair. I mean, I don't have that specific. Graph here, which would be just sort of the number of changes relative to the divergence time. But
where again, as you say, there's saturation, so just sort of that would be an interesting comparison.
Yes.
I'm trying to get an intuition as well. So more things that haven't diverged as much. All right, so define rewiring rate for me again.
Okay, so the rewiring rate is very simple. It's basically the number. So for the number of common nodes. Those are the nodes that you can get orthologs for. You figure out how many possible connections you could have between them, and then you look at the number of change connections as a fraction of those.
So of the possibles.
When you divide it, it's a pure mean of year, which means that you divide it by the x-axis to get to the y-axis, right?
But it's normalized the number of possible remaining changes. So
remaining.
After they've made a couple changes, there's less stuff that they have in common. So the denominator in that goes down, right?
I think the denominator is just a topological thing. Like, it's just you have a number of nodes, how many potential connections you could have them, how many of the connections are rewired as a fraction of the potential. Yeah, it's sort of like, let's think of percent identity for sequences, right? I mean, percent identity, right? I mean, it's the number of things that are the same, or you can say the number of changes relative to how many things are being compared, right? So that it's essentially the analog of percent identity. That's exactly what it is. I mean, this isn't very profound. I mean, it's trying to, in a percent identity, it's over the, it's the number of changes as a fraction of the total space of comparison, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, for networks, it has a little bit of a different structure because it's the number, it's like a squared thing, you know, you have to take into account all the potential connections.
The fact that all these lines are sloping down means that there's a lot of variation for rewiring rates within each of these kinds.
No. I think the sloping down reflects saturation. I mean, I think
if they were flat, it would be just the linear line.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's sloping down means as you move out to the right, it's tailing off, just like with sequences.
Yeah, this is just like sequences. You tend to, like, this is actually, you would get a very similar type of thought process with sequences, where like if you basically, as you look for more and more diverged things, they appear to have if you look compared to sequences, you saturate at like 25% of them. You just can't have any more change because you're just changing the same thing over again. So your number of change as you look for more diverged things, your sort of apparent rate of change falls off. And that's just simple sequence saturation. So that's the same thing you're seeing here.
Are the changes actually saturating?
Say what?
Are they actually saturating? You're actually changing like everything that you could change?
I don't know if I'd use the word everything, but I think you're affecting the same, I mean, you're hitting the same potential connections. So, I mean, saturation, I mean, like in saturation in two sequence comparisons, I mean, if I'm comparing two sequences, I change this base once, and then another time I go back and I change it again. Here it might be we look at different network changes and we affect the same connection between two genes.
These are comparisons being made not only between UK
eukaryotes?
Yeah, no, I think this, like I said, this is kind of going crazy. I think this is every possible connection or every possible comparison. So we're comparing. I mean, like I said, this is if you go to this table and you just take all the organisms in this table and you compare them. Now, like you might.
No prokaryotes here. I don't know what Calvin is.
That's correct.
I guess the thing that I was stuck on is I sort of associate bacteria with metabolic innovation. And I was trying to think how, according to certain comparisons that you might make, what kind of data would you see comparing a prokaryote?
That's true, but I actually, even though you're completely correct, I think you're thinking more in the Sergey talk lines, and I'm actually, it's true that there's metabolic innovation in bacteria, but actually I would sort of say the opposite, that when you have a pathway, the structure of that pathway is conserved. You might have a different pathway that does something different, but you don't so much change the connectivity of a given, once you establish, like, you know, to make this, you know, I go through this pathway. And so I think that's sort of what you're seeing. I mean, the metabolic pathways just don't change that much. And you can sort of see, you know, in a certain sense, okay, well, the final thing is, it's actually kind of easy to rationalize this picture. I mean, you know, on a simple-minded level, why do you get this picture like this? Well, think about it. If you want to rewire a metabolic pathway, this is painful. You have to create new enzymes that have new functionality that are going to match onto the same little molecules and do that reaction. This requires serious heavy lifting. Changing the transcriptional regulatory network is trivial. Basically, all you have to do is introduce a binding site, a little patch of DNA that your transcription factor will regulate. I mean, it's much easier to do that. I mean, it's you know, exponentially easier to do that.
We have the same message. I'm trying to map it onto what I know and what I did. We did the same study in 2003, but we didn't have so many genomes back, so many network data, so we used paralogs. For paralogs, you easily see how quickly, so the x-axis was the sequence identity among paralogous genes. The y-axis is how many shared transcription factors they have or binding partners. And we saw also that transcription regulatory networks evolve much faster than protein interaction.
Yes, yeah, and I think it sort of makes sense. Basically, to do a protein interaction, that's a more of a physical. I mean, changing a transcription factor binding site is a very digital type of thing. You have your bases, you flip a few of them, and I mean, you're in business. I mean, changing the shape of a binding interface is it's more painful, and rewiring a metabolic network even more painful than that.
Like, where's the null model expectations here? In other words, you know, I'm still worried about noise spoiling all this beautiful picture. So let's say for one of the lines, say green line, where would you expect this rewiring rate to be if you had nothing but noise in the data?
No, that's a good question. We did a bunch of random simulations where you randomly rewire. I mean, you can do, I mean, it's pretty easy to do. So you just take a network and you rewire it, you compare it, and so forth. I mean, but you have to be careful about exactly what you mean when you do that. Like, what I mean is, if you do the random rewiring of things, you're going to get the same type of fault, and you're obviously going to get the same saturation process. Your random graph is going to look, it's going to have the same downward structure, but the main conclusion of this graph
is a prefactor, right? I guess what I'm saying is the slope loop is the same in a random graph, but how much one of the, let's say, green points is higher than what you would get by pure chance?
The main conclusion of this graph isn't so much that the line goes down. It's the conclusion is that the green guys are up here and that the purple guys are down here. So if you want to compare this with the random thing, what you sort of have to do is you have to say, if I take the transcriptional regulatory network and I randomly rewire it, and I take an existing transcriptional regulatory network and I randomly rewire it, and I take a metabolic network and I randomly rewire it, will I get this same type of thing? And no, I don't have that picture here, but you don't get quite the same type of thing. That the metabolic network, if you randomly rewire, will change more than you see here. The transcriptional regulatory network will change a lot, but not so much more. They'll all change. I mean, if you randomly rewire them, they're all going to change pretty much the same.
But if randomly rewired, you can randomly assign orthologs, right? What I'm worried here is just, you know, not that I'm worried. I know that the signal is there. I just want to know how strong it is. So here you use the real orthologs. Let's say your rewiring is more like, I see this interaction of organism A, and here is my organism B, which separated from A 50 million years ago. How likely I am still to see this interaction? So even if you just have completely lack of correlation in networks, you would still see some of the interactions to coincide with each other by pure chance.
Yes.
So where is this pure chance like? How much down, if I compare grid to grid, how much the grid squares in real net, how much more likely am I to detect to interaction in mouse if I know that it exists in human compared to pure chance?
Yeah, no, I think we should have those plots on this, now that you put it like that. I mean, I think we could show for, I have to be careful about how we would show that. It's not so much another plot. It'd be like for each of these things you would kind of show. Yeah,
we added in this paper for paralogs, we saw that even the most distant paralog, which was a surprising fact, even if you look at the paralogs which diverged something like down to 40%, 30% sequence identity protein sequences, you still saw more shared regulators than you expect by your chance. So I wonder if you would still see the signal even for really ancient separations like...
Certainly as you get to more and more things, they're all going to... This is all like nothing meaningless, but at the tail, you're moving to like that saturation of stuff, and it's not... Okay. I mean, in a certain sense, the most informative stuff is here. It's just that the key idea is that you sort of see at least a consistent trend even out to here. But this is obviously in the infinite case, or you know, it's just all saturation. So I think we're pretty close. I expect we're pretty close to the end. I actually had another section, but I'm just going to show you your slides. It's a completely different thing. It's about analyzing Craig Venter's sailing trip around the ocean and looking at how the metabolic networks rewire or change in that. But that's for another day, or you can download the slides or something. And I'll just summarize just so that you can at least sort of get what we talked about. Just the summary of what we talked about is, you know, what I wanted to talk about is how networks can be used as a kind of fairly unifying language, and because of that, we can get a little bit of intuition on biological networks by comparing them to other types of networks. And so the first thing was we compared them to social networks or sort of social hierarchies, and you know, I think that there was just some, I think, neat things you could see. They actually had sort of similar structures. They both were sort of fairly hierarchical, and you have this kind of what I call paradox of influence versus essentiality, where you have the essential things at the bottom, the influential things at the top. And I think to some degree you can rationalize this in terms of information flow bottlenecks occurring in the middle layers and so forth, and you can get that through comparing different hierarchies. Then we have the, I think I have the next one here. Yeah, and then we have our comparison with the regulatory network in biological system and the Linux network, and I think there you saw a real difference. One, they essentially have different, at least the way we compare them, they have different pyramidal structures, and that really leads to a very different picture. I mean, I think in Linux you get this picture of a few things at the bottom that are just called by all things, and equally you have this tremendous amount of redundancy. The interesting thing I felt is that the things at the bottom, some of the things at the bottom in Linux evolve very quickly. And whereas, even though they're very connected, and I felt this has a lot to do with the non-robustness of software systems as opposed to the robustness of biological systems. And I think that's that. Well, there was also the comparisons of the different weights of the rewiring of the different networks, and we just saw that the transcriptional regulatory network rewires much faster than the protein interaction network, which rewires faster than the metabolic network. So those are the main conclusions. and then, you know, have acknowledgments and stuff, and I have more pictures of snow, just so you all feel very happy about yourself that you're here and stuff like that. The main people that did this are sort of shown in the black type here. So this Mitten Barjois was a postdoc with me. He did the a lot of the social network comparisons, and Kun Kyuyan was actually a student with Sergey, and I was a postdoc with me. He did the comparison with Linux. Haiwan Yu was a student with me, I guess, many years ago. Now he's an assistant professor at Cornell, and he actually started off with the comparisons of the regulatory networks. And Chang Xiao was a graduate student. He's just graduating. He did the comparisons of the networks between different organisms. And these people did a lot of stuff, but you didn't see it, and so I wouldn't acknowledge them. And that's about all.